saw the sign shaking, and then the aisle started moving, and we kind of, all three of us, are just standing around like,
Alaska residents described this morning's 6.2 magnitude earthquake. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 25th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a landslide wipes out a watershed restoration project near Sitka.
It wasn't until we actually climbed through the initial front of the slide that we actually saw the magnitude of it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A magnitude 6.2 earthquake hit south-central Alaska at 9:51 this morning. Michael West directs the Alaska Earthquake Center in Fairbanks. He says the epicenter was about 60 miles northwest of Anchorage and 60 miles underground.
That's pretty deep for Alaska, and the reason for that is that's where the Pacific Plate dives under North America in a process we call subduction. But because of that, we are well accustomed to seeing a line of progressively deeper earthquakes as we move north from the coast. So in that sense, this earthquake is not a surprise at all.
No major damage has been reported, but the shaking caught the attention of residents across a large swath of the state from Fairbanks down to Homer. In Anchorage, residents posted pictures on Facebook and Twitter of messy aisles in Fred Meyer, with shampoo bottles scattered across the floor and tiles missing from ceilings in midtown buildings. West says it's difficult to gauge the length of the earthquake. The Earthquake Center took reports from residents saying it lasted anywhere from several seconds up to a full minute. He says the deep basin of Cook Inlet may explain the difference.
The analogy we use is it kind of shakes like a bowl of jello. So certainly our hypothesis right now is that this earthquake set the basin shaking, and that because of that, people close to Cook Inlet may have felt this for a much, much longer time than other places. And that's kind of exciting because we see this in data sometimes, but we don't often have on-site reports from people confirming that kind of observation.
West says events like this one are a reminder of what earthquakes are capable of in Alaska. He says a strong earthquake like this one that was more shallow and centered closer to a city would be capable of causing widespread damage and even death. A 6.3 magnitude earthquake in Christchurch, New England in 2011 killed 185 people. West worries Alaskans have been lulled into assuming big earthquakes are no big deal.
So it's quite easy to think that, oh, there's another magnitude 6 or 7 that didn't do anything. And that is not in any way a predictor that magnitude 6 and 7 earthquakes don't hurt us. It just means we've been lucky yet again.
West is in Washington, D.C. right now to make the case for long-term funding for an expanded seismic network across Alaska to monitor earthquakes. This morning in downtown Anchorage, it was hard to find someone who didn't have a story to tell about their earthquake experience. KSKA's Ann Hillman talked to residents and filed this report.
Ken Bates-Holtz was walking on the Chester Creek Trail during the windless morning when the trees began moving and a flock of geese suddenly flew off. He says he followed suit and started running.
Because I was frightened, I had no idea exactly what it was. I just thought I'd get out of that clump of trees where I was, because a whole, flurry of leaves started to fall. Yeah, it was very peculiar.
Up the road at New Sagaya's Market, Erin Wade Hemphill was working at the coffee shop. She says the quake was obvious.
We saw the sign shaking, and then the aisle started moving, and we kind of, all three of us, are just standing around And then when things started falling and actually kind of falling off the shelves, we decided to get out of the building because there's a lot of stuff that can come down on us here. Usually they tell you, don't go outside. But we made the decision to go outside.
Some guests at the downtown Marriott fled the building as well. Valet Corey Roybal was outside when it happened, and people started evacuating the building. He says he tried to calm down the out-of-town guests,
It just sort of alarmed a lot of people, and you get people asking if we knew if there were aftershocks coming, you know, and it's, we just tell them, well, they're earthquakes, you know. I was like, no, you know, nothing like that.
Karen Gaborik is from Fairbanks. She says she's felt plenty of quakes before, but being in Anchorage made it different.
When you're, you know, in a larger city and near the coast and, you know, on silt, a little bit more concerning.
Gaborik was in the basement of the Dena'ina Center at the time, and she says she stayed put, but she wasn't sure if it was really the safest place to be. Up on the surface, Bill Speer was driving, and because of that, he was one of the few who said he couldn't feel a thing.
Unless it's severe, like in the 1964 earthquake where it was actually tossing cars around, no, there's no apparent indicators that there's an earthquake going on.
Speer says he only knew the quake was happening because he heard about it on the radio. But 10 stories up in a glass-walled corner office of the ConocoPhillips building, Elizabeth Lopez took cover under her desk.
I mean, the building rolled back and forth. We swayed to the left and right, and another jolt came in, and I started grabbing my cell phone and my bag.
Lopez is a floor warden and followed up with her office mates to make sure they were safe. She says it's important to be prepared.
Be ready to make sure you have your correct footwear and coverage, and then you follow what the exercise that we're supposed to do when, you know, duck, hide, and cover. And that's the best way. And do not ever leave the building unless someone tells you that it's safe to leave the building.
Others reported lampposts swaying, figurines breaking, and dogs crouching to the ground near their owners. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
A new Dittman Research poll shows Republican Dan Sullivan is 6 points ahead of Democrat Mark Begich in the U.S. Senate race. The research was funded by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It ran a pro-Sullivan ad in April and today officially announced its endorsement of Dan Sullivan. The poll shows Sullivan at 49% and Begich at 43%. The phone survey of 800 voters was conducted last week. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5%. The U.S. Chamber, in a written statement, pledged to put its full weight behind Sullivan. It has already spent more than $23 million to promote Republican congressional candidates around the country. That puts it in second place among groups making independent expenditures to influence the outcome of federal elections this year. In response to today's announcement, Begich campaign spokesman Max Crowe said the Koch brothers and Sullivan's parents are spending millions of dollars to buy the Alaska Senate seat. The Kochs are wealthy industrialists who, according to news reports, have given the U.S. chamber at least $2 million. Sullivan's parents and his brother have contributed at least $680,000 to independent groups running ads to promote Sullivan's candidacy. Sullivan's brother also sits on the board of the U.S. Chamber. The state says a lawsuit challenging the mechanisms that allowed two Alaska gubernatorial candidates to merge their campaigns would derail the November election and potentially disenfranchise voters if it succeeds. The state's position is detailed in court documents filed this week ahead of oral arguments set for Friday in the lawsuit against Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell and Elections Director Gail Fanumiai. The lawsuit filed last week by an Alaska Republican Party District Chair, Steve Strait, challenges an emergency ruling that allowed Democratic gubernatorial nominee Byron Mallott to join campaigns with independent gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker and run as Walker's lieutenant governor. Strait maintains that Treadwell erred in his September 2nd decision. The combined ticket is seen as a stronger challenge to Republican incumbent Governor John Parnell than a three-way race. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new way to register to vote in Alaska.
It's not officially endorsed by the Division of Elections, but it's been working, and they haven't had any problems with it so far.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
U.S. and Canadian Air Forces have scrambled jets twice over the past week to intercept Russian aircraft that have buzzed the Alaskan and Canadian coastlines twice in the past week. As KOAC's Tim Ellis reports, it's not unusual for the U.S. Air Force to intercept Russian aircraft flying near U.S. airspace off Alaska, but two events within a few hours of each other raised a few eyebrows among U.S. defense officials.
The latest round in the cat-and-mouse game between U.S. and Russian aircraft played out a week ago over the waters off Alaska's northern coast. Late last Wednesday, the Air Force scrambled two F-22s from the 3rd Wing at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson to intercept six Russian military aircraft that were flying within 55 nautical miles of the Alaskan coastline. The two MiG-31 jet fighters, along with two long-range bombers and two refueling tankers, didn't enter U.S. airspace, only the U.S. Air Defense Identification Zone. A few hours later, another pair of the Russian Tupolev bombers flew within 40 nautical miles of Canada's northern landmass. The pair turned back after being intercepted over the Beaufort Sea by two Canadian F-18s. Both times, the Russian-made Tupolev bombers didn't enter the U.S. or Canadian airspace during what Moscow has long referred to as training flights. The aircraft only entered the Air Defense Identification Zones, or ADIZ, which extends about 200 miles north off the coast of both the United States and Canada. Colonel David Nahom, the former commander of the 3rd Wing at Jaber, says that's an important distinction.
Russian long-range aviation flights, for instance, have entered our ADIZ, but not our Sovan airspace. These flights are perfectly legal, and we do not consider them threatening or provocative. When we intercept and identify their aircraft, both sides have exercised professional airmanship in all cases.
Nahom talked about U.S. and Russian aircraft encounters during a visit in May by Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Nahom left the 3rd Wing last summer to take a new position back in Washington, D.C. Based on Nahom's comments, last Wednesday's interdiction played out as it usually does, with the Russian bombers executing a turn away from the mainland after the U.S. warplanes show up.
They seem to be pretty constant. Over the last few years, you can average about 10 to 12 of such flights inside of our ADIZ per year. We have F-22s that sit alert here in Jaber, and when someone starts approaching the ADIZ, we do scramble out, meet them, and make sure that they don't go any further and approach U.S. airspace.
The Toronto Globe and Mail says U.S. and Canadian warplanes have intercepted about 50 Russian aircraft over the past 5 years, but the Christian Science Monitor reports that a North American Aerospace Defense Command spokesman said Friday that the flights are part of an increase in such activity near the Alaskan Air Defense Identification Zone. The Globe and Mail, the Monitor, and several other news media quoted U.S. officials saying they believe the two incidents were linked to Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's visits last week to the United States and Canada. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
High rainfall this month is being blamed for a major landslide near Sitka. The U.S. Forest Service reports that a 100-acre slide came down in the Starrigan Valley, about 10 miles from town. Although there was no structural damage in the event, hundreds of thousands of dollars of watershed restoration projects in the valley have been wiped out. KCIW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The scale of the Stargaven slide has unfolded slowly. A fish and game biologist was in the area apparently the morning after the slide on Friday, September 19th, and noticed that Stargaven Creek had been diverted onto the old logging road that is now being used as an all-terrain vehicle trail. Marty Becker is the Watershed Program Coordinator for the Sitka Ranger District. He and other staff went to check on the problem Monday morning.
And then it wasn't until we actually climbed through the initial front of the slide that we actually saw the magnitude of it.
There was not one slide, but three. Two smaller slides across both the north and south forks of Stargaven Creek.
One main slide that came down off the north-facing slope came down, ran approximately a third of a mile down the main channel and ended up at the Logstringer Bridge, which hung up the main slide.
Becker estimates the area of the main slide to be in the neighborhood of 100 acres, starting in the old-growth timber high on the valley slope and running down through the second growth to the valley floor. Becker says the Sitka District hasn't seen a cluster of slides like this since the mid-1990s in Nakwasina Sound and the Catlan area, which he says are more dynamic systems. The Stargavin slide, Becker says, is pretty extraordinary.
Boy, those freaky events that we have is it kind of keeps us on our toes.
The log stringer bridge in the Stargavin Valley is a lost cause. At the other end of town, Mike Mullen is on the Herring Cove Trail next to a footbridge that his crew is working hard to save.
You know, these guys will get a gap underneath it and we'll get a lot of that material flushed through and we might end up jacking the bridge up and, you know, raising it a couple feet, but I'm hoping there's no big, once we uncover all the rock and debris, that there's not some big chunks out of it, so I'm hoping it can be saved.
This is the second time this year that the trail has sustained major water damage. All the repairs from last January's flooding have been washed out. Two minor slides have cut the trail, and this footbridge over the stream, while it hasn't moved, is more or less sitting on dry land. Heavy rains over two consecutive weekends in September pushed rocks under the bridge and turned it into a dam. It doesn't look like it will survive another high rainfall event. Mullen says the Forest Service is basically between a rock and a hard place.
The couple events we've had this summer have been a little bit out of the ordinary for sure, but yeah, we're not even in the rainy season, and not that we have a big seasonal crew, but we're losing them in a couple weeks, and obviously Forest Service budgets for maintaining trails is on the decline too, so kind of got a lot of things working against us.
Mullen says the agency will likely have to consider realigning the trail away from the alluvial fan at the base of Bear Mountain Falls into a less dynamic area. Both the Herring Cove Trail and the Stargavin Valley were probably affected by what Marty Becker calls a microburst. Meteorological data for Sitka doesn't indicate rainfall amounts too extraordinary for this time of year, but the rain came hard and fast. What was officially recorded as 3.5 inches of rain at the Sitka Airport on the day the Herring Cove Trail was damaged, Becker says, filled rain gauges in some parts of town to nearly 7 inches. In the Stargavin Valley, the mitigation strategy is uncertain. Three of the Forest Service's coho rearing ponds were lost in the slide. A fourth was almost completely filled with sediment. Two fish culverts have been blown out, and a half mile of stream, several forest test plots, and 300 meters of the ATV trail are just gone. The Forest Service has invested several $100,000 in restoration work in this valley. Becker is not sure to what extent the agency will attempt to undo some of the damage.
Yeah, that's the big question right now. We're going to be sitting down in the next couple days of assessing what we know right now, getting some aerial reconnaissance to see if there's more slides that we haven't seen, and then getting out there probably in the next week or so after we let things stabilize a little more. It's pretty dangerous out there. Things are still shifting around. To actually get a full inventory of what's been damaged, where the main problem areas are, and then just to see what we can actually do.
The last slide of this magnitude around Sitka happened at Redoubt Lake in May of 2013, and two people staying at the Forest Service cabin there managed to escape moments before the mountainside came down. Becker says both slides are comparable in size, but he says the resource damage here is greater because the Redoubt slide was stopped by the lake, and in Stargavin, it just came right down the valley. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere, and celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
Alaskans 18 to 24 are the age group least likely to vote. About a third of them aren't registered, and of those who are, fewer than half actually come out on election day. But a college freshman from Juneau would like to change that by making the whole process a little more convenient. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports on a new voter registration site for cell phone users.
Stephen Mell is in his first weeks at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. His list of priorities is pretty typical for a freshman.
Number one is definitely Spanish class. The next one, I don't know, probably getting enough sleep, which I never seem to manage. And then I guess the rest of my classes, and somewhere over there, there's the rest of the world, but it's pretty small.
Even though what's going on in the rest of the world and back in Alaska isn't a top concern in his daily life, Mel still cares enough to vote. To do that, he's got a few options. He could fly back.
No, that would be very expensive.
He could scan his vote and email it to the Division of Elections or submit an absentee ballot via fax machine.
I might be able to figure it out. It would be stressful.
Or he can request an absentee ballot by mail.
I don't have any envelopes except for the ones that my mom mailed to me with my grandmother's address on them so that I can send letters to her.
The whole process feels like a chore to Mel, and like something that could end up discouraging students away at college from voting. Mel thinks more students would vote if they could just register or request absentee ballots from their cell phones. So he built a mobile website that will let them do exactly that.
The entire idea was to make it as easy as possible.
And it is. Testing out the site from a smartphone, registering to vote takes about 5 minutes. You go to vote-ak.us, fill out your vitals, swipe your signature on the touchscreen, and that's pretty much it. With the push of a button, your form gets submitted to the state for processing.
It's not officially endorsed by the Division of Elections, but it's been working, and they haven't had any problems with it so far.
Vote-ak.us isn't fancy. Mel says developing it took about 20 hours. He chose to build a mobile site instead of an app, partially because it was easier for him to program. Plus, a slick design and bells and whistles might actually make it less user-friendly and require people to spend more time registering. Mel also acknowledges that some people might be a little wary about trusting what's essentially a student side project, but he says he doesn't get access to any of the sensitive information that's submitted.
I see the name of the person who registered, but I do not get their social security number. That is discarded immediately. It is never stored to a hard drive.
Every time someone signs up, Mel gets an alert. So far, only 10 people, mostly his friends, have used the site to register. But he's hoping the idea will take off and that more people will use it once they learn about it.
Maybe someday I won't be able to put up with having that many notifications.
The final day to register to vote is October 5th. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Juneau Police Lieutenant Chris Sell has been appointed by Governor Sean Parnell to serve on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. Sell is the only active police officer to serve on the commission, which was created by a bill that passed the legislature earlier this year. Its purpose is to evaluate sentencing laws and law enforcement practices and to make recommendations for improving the system. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield has more.
Lieutenant Sell says she was asked to apply after Department of Corrections Deputy Commissioner Ronald Taylor recommended her for the appointment. Sell says she's never served on a commission like this before, but is looking forward to the challenge. She returned to Juneau earlier this week after the commission's first meeting in Anchorage.
We're kind of spending this first month trying to get our arms around this issue as to, you know, really how do we do corrections better? How do we make the public safer and get the most impact out of our corrections dollars and really chart a course for the future?
Alaska has the nation's highest rate of criminals who reoffend. Senate Bill 64, the omnibus crime bill that created the commission, was aimed at lowering that rate and preventing the state from having to construct another prison in the near future. The bill was modeled after so-called smart justice policy reforms and initiatives that have shown up in states like Texas, Florida, California, and Washington. Sell says she's familiar with some of the reform models.
I'm still, you know, learning a lot of what's out there, and I'm not willing to say I've come to a lot of conclusions at this point. I would say that, you know, I'm the last person who would agree that somebody who's dangerous should be out on the street.
Sel is married to former state prosecutor Patrick Gullifson. When asked if she and her partner discuss policy issues, Sel said yes, but that she consults with many people in her work. She's also vice president of the Alaska Peace Officers Association.
I have a lot of connections. There's also prosecutors I work with almost every day. So I'm sure that we'll discuss things, but I will discuss things with other prosecutors as well. And I can tell you, you know, we don't always see things the same way.
Sel said of all the reform ideas she's heard, one she's not keen on is lessening punishment for drug crimes. While she definitely sees a need for increased rehabilitation services, she says drug sentencing should stay as it is. She even testified during the last legislative session against a bill introduced by Senator Fred Dyson of Eagle River, which would have significantly changed how certain drug crimes are prosecuted. Dyson's intent with the bill was to keep more nonviolent offenders out of Alaska's jails. Sel now works with Dyson on the commission.
It came up when I was interviewed for this position that I did come out against Senator Dyson's bill and testified against it to make certain drug possession crimes, to lessen the consequences for those. And Senator Dyson is involved in this committee. So this committee was not built to service one viewpoint.
Sel says she hopes to bring the law enforcement perspective to a commission that will be discussing at times intangible ideas about how to reform the criminal justice system in Alaska. She says that while she appreciates and supports some creative solutions to criminal justice problems, the commission will need to consider the perspective of the law enforcement officers who are often first responders to violent or dangerous situations.
Lofty academic ideas can sometimes be a disaster in the middle of the night in a dark alley or inside a home filled with terrified children and a traumatized spouse. My job is to bring to some of these discussions that real-world view.
Others on the commission include retired and current state judges, commissioners from the Departments of Public Safety and Corrections, Attorney General Michael Garrity, and representatives from various social service organizations across the state. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Jim Ellis in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Alaska Native elders are 5 times more likely to be injured in a fall, but there are simple ways for elders to reduce fall-related injuries. Get an eye exam every year. Stay informed about medications that can cause dizziness. Exercise regularly to increase strength and balance, and keep your home clutter-free. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.